Hey folks, we're back. Bootstrapped Web, another episode. Jordan just got back from Europe from MicroConf. We'll talk a bit about that. And today we're welcoming back Ian Landsman to the show. You were just on a couple weeks ago, and Ian is one of our recurring guests. We've got a few more lined up over the next couple weeks, but Ian, good to have you back on.
Hey, how's it going? Part of the family now.
That's right.
Nice. Party episode.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So the thing that we planned for today is just the word pricing. And we figured that's enough for us to just talk probably endless amounts of time just talking about pricing and all that goes into it. Whether it's an art, whether it's a science, who knows?
Right.
It's a guess. Is it an average of your competitors? You know, all the myriad ways you can get pricing wrong.
So we'll dive into that. But you know, before we get into it, Jordan, how was MicroConf Europe?
MicroConf was cool, man. It's always cool. And this was my first European adventure for it. Barcelona is a great city. Most of the time was in the hotel, obviously, but we did get a chance to get out a little bit. It's a good vibe. Yeah, it was very interesting to just come across like the European version. There's a lot of people from the DC, a lot of people who are really into travel, a big mix of software, services, some more niche stuff. It was cool.
Is it a big overlap between the DC and MicroConf now? I know that there are some, but I've never really noticed that in previous MicroConfs. And I just joined the DC earlier this year, and I've been to a couple meetups, but I'd like to go out to their conferences too.
I'm not sure. It could have just been the fact that I came across a few people from the DC just in conversation.
Nice.
It was also, they have a big representation in Barcelona, right? One of the
founders. Oh, that's right.
They've lives got in their Barcelona.
Big, yeah.
Right. And they have their, they had at least one of the meetups or conferences.
Yeah, they do like a major conference there. So yeah.
Right. So maybe that was part of it and the European thing. So there were definitely a handful of people there that I got to meet. And that was cool. They have a slightly different perspective from the MicroConf regular crowd and the software crowd. They're kind of on this in-between of e-commerce, Amazon, software, services mixture, but always really focused on the location independence and freedom thing. It's good to just kind of soak it in.
What I'm always interested in, last year I went to MicroConf Barcelona, which was amazing. I really would like to get out there next year. What is the difference between Vegas and Barcelona, or Vegas and Europe in general? Any thoughts there?
It was very much the same crowd and same interests. I think maybe the intensity was toned down 1 degree, right? Whereas Vegas, you know, some of the speakers are just kind of ballers, and it's just like a little bit more intense in terms of like how far along the companies are, who the speakers are. It felt very similar. It was just a fewer people. So while the intensity level was kind of turned down by one notch, it also made for a really just pleasant environment to just actually chill out and get to know people. So that part of it was good, you know, and everyone's just kind of hanging out in the same place for a few days. So you really just get to come across a bunch of people, have a beer with a few people, grab dinner, and just kind of lounge around talking. And then as you start these conversations, everyone makes connections of, oh, I just spoke to someone that you should speak to. And then that starts to just naturally happen.
Yep. Yep. Very cool. Ian, when are you going to make it out to a MicroConf again?
I know. I got to get back out there. I don't know. It's every year it's been, I'm like, I got to go. And then I've only been the year I spoke at. But, you know, a few years there, I was like, you just couldn't get tickets. And then, but even now, I think it's still kind of that way. But I don't know. I'm on some lists, I think, where I could get in there. But it's just, I don't know. It hasn't been aligning up with like either kid stuff, or 1 year we had like a big launch thing going on. So I don't know. The European one, I that would be kind of cool to head out to that one, I think, and get a chance to write off a trip to Europe.
Yeah, totally.
Kind of hang out for a week or whatever. But just conferences in general, it's like I used to go to more of them, but it's hard to find time.
They're never worth it.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
It's literally.
There's no like ROI. Excuse to write something off and have some fun.
Well, at least with MicroConf, you go in, and this is almost the nature of MicroConf. You go in not looking for ROI.
Right.
You just go because it's fun and you want to see people, and the ROI just kind of happens. Whereas other conferences are much more transactional, and you're like, I literally need to make this worth my $3,000.
Right. And MicroConf, you kind of know everybody, or I mean, at least us, you know, I mean, last Mike Carmen went to, I think I literally knew almost everybody, or at least everybody knew me from the podcast or whatever. So that's a cool vibe to just be able to, have conversations.
It's a little good for the ego too. It's right.
Good. I think that's my whole approach to conferences is like, right. I only go if I don't care about any sort of ROI from it.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think if I do care about ROI, then it's probably a conference that's just going to bore the hell out of me, you know?
Well, I also think that I'm kind of big on now only going to conferences where the networking is kind of a given. So like where I'm not, you know what I mean? So like MicroConf, I know everybody knows me. We support this Laravel conference. So everybody knows me and I know everybody basically. And PeersConf is another conference I do where a lot of people, like I know a lot of people. And so I'll meet people I don't know through the people I know. Or if you're a speaker at the conference, right, that's always great because then everybody's seen you speak and they'll come up to you and whatever. To kind of go back to where I was like 15 years ago and be like, I'm just at this conference with 3,000 people. I don't know anybody and I got to like make the networking happen. I don't know if I have the bandwidth for that at this point.
And
those are the kind of conferences too where it's like I got to see the 7 sessions on AdWords optimization and come away with a takeaway and all this kind of stuff. It's harder mentally anyway on me. I don't know.
The advantages of podcasting.
Right.
Definitely. The advantages of having a podcast. And even if you don't, and I mean, it's definitely a benefit of having a network and growing an audience. But what I always try to do, especially with MicroConf, is just reach out to people. Like Jordan, you and I have kind of organized a dinner. Try to plan something before you even get there with folks and get a crew together so that you can. A couple of years ago, I went to a few conferences where I was just a conference goer, basically knowing nobody, and I hated it. Didn't have a good time, and I was like, "Screw conferences, I'm done. Yeah. I'm done with all conferences." And then, I went to MicroConf.
Situation where you're like, you're forced to social climb.
Yeah.
And if you're not that into that, then it's kind of like this, like, really? Is this what I should be doing with myself?
Well, for so many of us, I feel like now the conferences, not we all, but many people, especially in our circles, are working from home. And so, you know, this is like our chance to get out of the house and be with people like every day, all day I'm with people. And so if it's just me going somewhere and being by myself, I could do that at home or whatever, like, or if I have to really push it like that. Or it's also going to be a lot of corporate people, those kind of things. So you're also in a little bit of a different place where they're, you know, there for their job and it's kind of a different vibe to it. So yes. I think I did go to Saster last year earlier this year.
How was that? That sounds like an in-between.
Almost. Yeah, it was kind of in-between. Like I knew some people, but I didn't, you know, I mean, there's a lot of people there and I definitely didn't know everybody. It was nothing like a MicroConf situation, but it was like I knew enough people that it was fine. Like, and we had some fun and all that. It was it's hard to say, you know, they're so focused there on like a different level, like getting to $1 billion, right? Like they're focused on the getting to $1 billion. And so some of those lessons are hard to internalize at kind of our bootstrap level here. But there was some good stuff and they had like Atlassian there, which is bootstrapped and the CEO was talking. And so there was definitely some good stuff. If it's like you have a tight budget, I don't know if it's worth the money to go, but it was all right. I'd say it was pretty good. For that kind of conference, for what it is, it was a couple of cool things there that were I learned and all that. And going, I've never been to San Francisco, so it was also a reason to go to San Francisco.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I've become much more of a fan of like small meetups and even just like getting together with a group of people for dinner or whatever. But like, I like the idea of small meetups, especially the way that the DC does it all over the place. Like every city, you can find a DC meetup. I would love to see Rob and Mike, you know, spin off MicroConf to, you know, into some sort of like smaller meetup style MicroConfs.
Yeah, we do it ourselves here in Portland. We have a MicroConf lunch once a month.
Oh, nice.
With just a bunch of people. Because if you ever go to MicroConf and you start asking people where they're from, there are like 30 people.
I know.
From
like like half the conference is from Portland.
Yep. So we just do it ourselves. We just have, you know, second Wednesday of the month. We just, you know, email out where we're going to lunch and everyone who can joins. We usually have somewhere between 8 and 15 people.
Yeah. I've been kind of forming monthly drinks and dinner meetups around here. Kind of like that with, you know, business owners, entrepreneurs, but the scene in suburban Connecticut is not the same as Portland.
No.
I tried to do the same. I just started this like last month. I was trying to do a business of software kind of meetup in Poughkeepsie here. but it's really hard. Like, so far we have, and I put some limits on it because I really didn't want people who weren't already selling software, because otherwise I could definitely get a group of people who just want to be in software, and there's already a couple groups like that. But I was, you know, I wanted people who are more like, yes, I have $50,000 in revenue at least, or just like a baseline of revenue, so that you can have a conversation about like marketing or hiring or like all the different things
similar,
that come up.
Similar problems.
Well, Ian, you and I are what, like less than 2 hours away. So
yeah, we should do that.
We gotta get the word out to some folks here in the Northeast.
Well, the only two people, there's three people signed up. One is in my town. He's a mobile app guy, so he's a good fit. And the other two people are like, one's in Connecticut somewhere, and one is on Long Island, Butov, who doesn't even count. Other than that, I've literally found nobody. We could consult Northeast regional business.
We're only near the biggest city in the world, and we can't find anybody.
Yeah, if you go down in there, but then some of the stuff in New York is crazy. It's like 800 people, and then that's like its own thing. You know?
Exactly.
Tech meetup is like, well, we max out at 1,000 people per thing, and there's 13,000 people on the wait list. Or whatever.
I would like whatever this is to not happen in New York City. But
yeah,
somewhere
yeah. True. But it does make, yes, that's true. It is it's a central meeting spot with trains and everything, which is kind of handy. But yeah, we should talk about that. It's a good idea.
I'll just say one thing about the conference thing and the differences between MicroConf and others. You need people at the conference that you can look to for inspiration.
Yeah.
That are further ahead, that are more successful, whatever. You're just looking up toward them being like, I want to be in that position. I want to strive for that. But you don't want that many people so far above that it makes you feel like shit.
Right.
So I feel like the Saster thing is like, I don't know. There's one thing to be inspired, another thing to just make you feel bad.
Yeah. And there's also the idea that like, they're talking about stuff that's not practical in any way. Well, we put these 100 kids out of college on cold calling 3,000 businesses a day. Well, like that's not like a realistic thing I can implement, you know? So you end up with some stuff like that, or they have like obviously like a lot more employees. So there's, you know, they're already specialized and things like that. And so a lot of that stuff isn't, it's just hard to, and some of it's interesting. Like there were definitely talks that I thought were, you know, just interesting, but they weren't applicable really to me.
Yeah. So. You end up listening to it and saying, what tidbits from this can I take? Most of it is not applicable to people. What lessons can I learn and translate into my version of what you're talking about?
And my rule I have for myself of conferences is if I could just learn one thing, like my only goal really is to get one thing that's worth doing. So instead of having I'll often have the notebook full, right, where you're writing down, it's a whole big thing. But then the reality is if you can just get one thing that you take away that does anything for you at all, that's probably successful, because most conferences you don't actually take away a win out of them.
It's funny when you get it. When you come across that thing, you're like, oh shit, that's the thing right there. That's it. I had it this time while on stage, we were doing a panel and someone else on the panel, it was three of us. It was myself, James Kennedy from Rubberstamp.io and Greg Mercer from Jungle Scout. And Greg from Jungle Scout was answering someone's question, and he gave the thing that I took away. I looked at him and was like, holy shit, that's it right there.
Nice. I got it on stage.
Yep. It's all about the mindset that you have going into the conference or whatever wherever you're currently at in your business. And you know that you like listen to talks or you listen to conversations differently than you would another year, you know?
Yep. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Cool.
So what are we talking about today?
Let's talk about pricing. How do you do it?
I can tell my origin story of my pricing.
This will be
funny. So this is like 12 years ago, whatever. And I'm going to price HelpSpot. It was, you know, owned license at the time. And I was like, all right, $99 a user. And like a couple days before we started like talking about the pricing, and I guess when we released it, and my model for that was just like Spolsky and Fogbugs, and Fogbugs was $99 a user. And even though it's a bug tracker and a help desk, I was like, whatever. If Spolsky's doing it, it's all right.
Per user per month?
No, this was just per user owned.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So it's just an owned license, $99, you own it. And then, you know, whatever, $49 a year was the support, which is optional. So, and then the last minute, I was like, you know what? $99, I don't know. That seems awfully cheap. So I just doubled. I went to like $179. Just like no reason at all. I just made it $179. And I guess it worked. Like we're still here. And like we made enough money the first year to like my wife to quit her job and everything. So like it all worked out. But at the same time, I have no idea if like maybe I would have sold triple at 99. I don't know. Or maybe I would have only made half the money. But that's kind of my philosophy of pricing. It's like, who the hell knows? Like,
I don't know. Just look at someone you admire, and if they're doing it somewhat right. Yeah.
I think as you get farther along, you get more data of your own customer base or whatever, but that early on pricing is so hard.
Yeah, early on, exactly. It's such a gut feel, at least it has been for me as well.
Yeah.
The thing that scares me is all that data gets based on what you chose originally.
Yeah,
it's true. So you don't actually get an indication of like if your starting point was right. You get an indication on what the reaction is to your starting point at that point in time.
Right, yeah.
And it's like that could just derail you in completely the wrong direction.
And especially if you're not a big company, it's hard to run these pricing tests for a long time because you could take a beating and that beating like might put you out of business or, you know, mean you have to let somebody go or whatever because you're doing this pricing test and yeah, if you want to run it for 6 months, that could be a hard test to run there. So
yeah. So I mean, like if you're just starting out and right now, you know, I'm actually working on a few new ideas for new products from Audience Ops. So I'm thinking through pricing from like a starting fresh standpoint as well. What are the big factors that we should take into account? So that you've got competition. What are, if you make a list of competing companies, what are they charging? You've got the value of the product itself, or, you know, try to do like some sort of value-based pricing.
I think those two should be flipped.
Yeah. No, I'm not ranking them. You know, I'm just kind of listing. I think that if you're scratching your own itch to a certain extent, you could think about like, well, what would I pay for this? Right. You also have to look at the cost structure, right? Like how much does it cost to deliver the service and all that. I guess those are the factors that come to mind. And when I think through that stuff, I weight those a little bit differently. Like right now I'm going through this process, as I said, and I definitely put competition down on the list. Like they're not a top priority for me. They really never have been. What I do think about in terms of competition is like, what is the person probably going to compare this to? And that may not necessarily be a competing company, but like for instance, the Audience Ops done for you service. I always think in my mind, like, what does it compare to hiring somebody full time to do this? Like that's really the competition that we're against.
Yeah, that's closer to the value thing. The cost structure should basically be ignored entirely. Like how much it costs you to deliver the software, delivering the service is more relevant. But if it's software, I don't think the cost it takes to provide it, I think that's completely beside the point. The competition thing, I feel like is hard to ignore.
I'm more into the competitive kind of analysis end of it. But I think there's also a distinction between Audience Ops, which is, you know, a productized service kind of offering and has a heavy service component, and versus, you know, help desk software, which is borderline commodity, and there's a lot of competition there.
I was going to say, it depends on the market you're in and how competitive it is, but also how aware your customers are. I mean, thinking about Restaurant Engine, I was very aware of like five or six exact definite competitors. They do restaurant websites, like, you know, absolute competitors. And I almost knew for a certainty that 80% plus of our customer base had no idea that they existed.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. Yeah. That's a good spot to be in, especially if you want to focus on value-based pricing, because then you know they're not coming at you with, well, I talked to these three other firms and they are going to do it for X. You know, you don't have any of that. Or do they just discount you out of hand because you're more expensive, those kind of things. We, you know, at HelpSpot, we definitely get a lot of like, hey, you're one of seven we're looking at. And we got charts and graphs and committees and, you know, it's all factored in there. And for some people, the price is a huge thing. And for other people, the price isn't. And a lot of times it's weird. Like you'll have a company that's got 200 people who are going to use this thing. And they have, so that's what, $20 million in payroll or whatever. But they're upset that it's going to cost, you know, $12,000 instead of $10,000. You know, like they'll be heavy on the kind of cost end. But then you have other people, right, who are like, we would have paid triple for it. We don't care at all. And it might be a small company. So,
yeah. And there's also a point, I think, in most products or most markets where being the lowest or being one of the lowest disqualifies you from some buyers. Like they want to spend more, or they need to spend more in terms of to spend a budget or
Yeah, the assumption that being the cheapest will help you win in that scenario when people are comparing is not a good assumption.
I know we've traditionally been kind of low to mid tier on our price and not the cheapest, which is, I mean, there's just open source, right? Which is just straight up free. And then there's definitely cheaper, but we tend to not be much above middle of the pack, generally, historically. I like that spot because it appeals to the people who don't have a lot to spend, but it also doesn't out of hand disqualify you as being non-functional. I don't know. I think going up market is tricky for a bootstrapper. Like, there are people doing it right. But this is one of the things I worry about when you talk about like, or like Patio 11, right? We'll often be like, charge more. And people are very big on charge more. But charge more, especially B2B, will often require a lot of things around that that you aren't going to be able to provide. So can you really run a sales process for something that you're trying to sell for $50,000?
Or at least once you hit a certain threshold. Right. Like you can increase the price, but at a certain point, that is going to change the whole way you sell it.
Yeah. It gets into like, they're going to need a lot more of everything. They're going to need professional services, you know, and sometimes it might be lower than you think. I think something, you know what I mean? It's not always a six figure deal. Like there can be deals that are lower than that need those things. And so we do some of those things, but we also don't go all the way to, you know, we're not flying out to see you. We're not going to give you, you know, that kind of in-person presentations or do a full implementation generally, things like that.
So the way I tend to think of it is in terms of like being like low to mid tier or where is my place in within a certain tier. I mean, my approach when I buy products, whether it's SaaS products or services or whatever, is like I usually have just a really loose ballpark budget. And if I'm comparing three products and they're like $10 apart from one another, in my mind, they're equal. Like I'm not going to buy on price at that point. If I'm like a little 5-10% above the mid, right, the middle,
yeah,
tier,
it's not
gonna,
like, kill you.
What's the difference?
You know? Yeah, right. That's actually an interesting thing to dive into. It's from the other perspective. What is it that makes someone's mind up? If you are not significantly cheaper or more expensive, then what is it that pulls someone in, and what is it that pulls you into making it? You know, for me, it's like this weird combination of features and affinity for the company and product and the feel of it and what they're saying and how they say it and the founder. It's like this crazy mix.
A big one for me on that is, how confident am I that this company is going to stick around for at least another year?
Right. That's the big one.
You know,
I think I ignore that. I just assume
founders like ignore that.
Yeah.
A buyer and like a B2B.
Wouldn't want anyone to judge me.
There are things that I think about that. I'm just trying to think of examples. Like, well, first of all, any product that I'm buying to then build into for my customers, like for example, on Restaurant Engine, I bought several premium plugins which I gave access to for my customers.
Oh, I see.
I can't have those products go out of business.
Yeah, that's scary.
You know, and even I don't know, like core things like now, like if I'm looking at web hosting providers or even like email marketing tools, even help desk stuff, like. It wouldn't be the complete end of the world to have to switch providers, but it would be a huge pain for my whole team to learn a new system.
Yeah. You know? You don't want to have to do that. Yeah. That trust thing is huge. I mean, I think especially B2B is like the money, they're not paying with their money, but they care about their job. And if they pick wrong, that's going to reflect really poorly on them having made a bad choice. Do you know what I mean? And so they're worried about their career. They may be worried about the money, or they may not be, but there's a huge trust factor there where I feel like when you deal with founders, sometimes they're the one making the call and then they can switch if they have to. There's less of that. They're not going to get in trouble for making the wrong call.
Yeah, but a lot of founders don't want to have to deal with it again.
Of course, they don't want to
they want to deal with it once and be done with it. At least that's how I am.
I mean, getting to the point where you've been in business a long time is definitely an awesome thing you should need to take advantage of if you've accomplished that, to let people know that you've done that. And that's the thing we use a lot, like when people do ask about our size, because they're worried about that we're kind of small compared to, you know, obviously other help desk solutions. But, you know, we've been profitable for, you know, 140 months in a row or whatever, you know, so like,
yeah,
you can
helps.
Bring out some of those things that are valuable. And like, I have a slide I use in some of my talks that I've given where like HelpSpot profit, you know, is, you know, millions of dollars and Zendesk is zero, which is true. You know, they've never made any money. And,
cool.
Zendesk is probably not going out of business at this point, but there are a ton of other help desk. I mean, I've seen a million help desk apps, right, come and go over the years. So there is something to be said for being profitable and stuff. So that ends up being something you kind of leverage at times.
So your company, your product has been around a lot longer than both Brian and myself. Even being in business for a short amount of time with Carthook, with the cart abandonment thing, I still look back and I say, if I screwed up pricing, how much did that cost me?
Yeah.
Right. Do you ever look at it and say, you know, it really could have changed the trajectory of your whole company if you had done something differently? Just pricing wise, obviously
not. I felt pretty okay pricing wise. Like in, we kind of like set that pricing and then we raised it a little bit, you know, every couple of years and it was all right. I think the things I end up thinking about are not the things we did right, but the wrong things we've done. So just historically. And there's two big ones, and one was pretty recent. The other one was like maybe 6 years ago, we offered unlimited with the idea that like we would bring people up into unlimited who are maybe just had a lot of licenses, but not, you know, we could bring them up to a higher tier and make it like a regular every year. You just pay us this. It was $8,000. And it was a horrible idea because we had all these customers with hundreds of licenses that moved to unlimited and It cost us a bunch of money because now they were getting it for way cheaper. You know, these were all the people willing to pay us $20,000 a year and instead they're only paying us eight. So that was kind of brutal. So we killed that after like 2 years or so. But I mean, we still honor those and all those people still have them. And it's fine. It's like regular $8,000. So it's not bad, but it's just that, you know, you didn't maximize that there. So that was bad. And then the other thing is recently we had our just so kind of same owned license model for a long time. And then we moved to subscription. And what we did first for about 6 months, we did just per user, kind of like every other app out there, is like $25 a user. And that was a bad move because we hit a lot of trouble with like, we do deal with a lot of larger installations, but we're kind of like on the value end of that. And so at $25 a user, you get into really expensive costs there. And it just wasn't working out for us. And we also just lost a lot of trial users even because I think it just was like they were like, well, it's going to be too expensive, even though we would have negotiated with them or whatever. That kind of burned us a little bit. So we switched our pricing again and it instantly had a huge effect upwards. So
that's a big question, right? Is like per user or not per user? I know there was some talk about this in MicroConf Vegas. I tend to see too many SaaS going with the per user model when it just does not apply to their product. But other products, it definitely does apply. So I guess, how do you think about that?
Well, my new thinking on that is, so what happened here is that we had this big benefit that I think we didn't realize how important it was. So some of it is just the surface, it's too expensive. But then also longer term, I think it was starting to hurt us. And after 6 months or so, it wasn't killing us yet. But in the old owned license model, so it was per user, but we also had 5 packs and 10 packs that were pretty heavily discounted and people tended to buy those. That was the vast, it was very rare for people to buy like individual licenses. They normally would buy into the packs and they might add individual licenses later if they just needed a person or whatever, but they'd buy these packs. And even if they added people, very often they would buy at least 5 pack or 10 pack or 20 pack. And what happens is they end up having extra. And so it actually works out really nice because they need to add somebody. Most of the time they have a slot just free. And then occasionally they don't. Okay, they buy some more packs. But when you go per user, now they have to come back to you every single time. And that's a big burden for them to always be thinking of that buying decision every single time. And you also don't get – we had a lot of serendipity where, okay, we have 5 extra licenses in our install. Let's let HR use it. They say they need a ticketing kind of thing. Let's just put them in there, right? And so now you're exposing it to other parts of the organization. But again, if you're strictly per user where there's no kind of overflow there, then HR buying a ticketing system becomes like a whole thing with a committee and a discussion and everything because there's not any extra capacity. So you can't just like let them try it. Yeah, so that hurt us. And what we did is we moved to more of a tiered model now. So it's subscription, but it's like up to 10, up to 25, up to 50.
Yeah, I tend to like the tiered or the packed approach because, you know, because then what happens is what I've seen with some products is that they're charging based per user and per feature or right, by feature set.
So it's like that's too much.
Yeah, and
it gets complicated.
So I think you run into problems when you're combining those things, because I want to upgrade just to get X feature, but I don't care about having multiple users, you know? So there's that kind of conflict. The other conflict that I see is freemium and then charging per user, which I just don't think, there may be exceptions to this, but I just don't think that that really works. And I think the company that I'm thinking of here is Slack. AudienceOps is still a free user of Slack, and we've got over 20 people in our team Slack chat room.
Right. And for you to move to paid would be a big...
Yeah, for us to move to paid would be per user. So that'd be going from zero to over, you know, it'd be over a three digit every month. And so I was looking at that the other day. I was like, you know, I really want the groups feature. That would just make things a little bit easier for us. We can communicate and just tag groups rather than having to tag like six different people when we won't only want to tag a certain department or whatever. And, you know, that's a premium feature. So just, I actually emailed their support. I was like, just charge me $40 a month just for that feature. Right. And they're like, no, like you'd have to sign up for $160 a month. You know?
Well, yeah, they're also a different thing, because the only thing they're focused on is users, just the number of users. Yeah. They just think, hey, because look, Brian, you know, between you and Slack, let's be honest, you're going to be paying them sometime over the next 12 months.
Probably.
Right. So they kind of know that. Ian, the one thing I have to comment on, I'm looking at your pricing. You guys are doing something that most software companies do not have the balls to do, which is only offer annual.
Yes.
You guys have no monthly option, which is so much better than monthly, but still something that, I mean, nobody, not... I can't think of that many software companies
It's fairly common in the WordPress product space, although WordPress tends to be way underpriced to a fault.
Really? Right, like plugins where it's like $79 for the year.
And I think that's a function of your market pretty much. You know, so when we first moved to the subscription, the $25 a user, we did off monthly. I hate everything about monthly. I don't think I'd ever do monthly again under any scenario. Or maybe not any is too strong a word, but I really dislike the monthly. In our particular space, anyway, people tend to be making a commitment to this thing for a serious amount of time. Like Brian just said, like for him to switch help desk tools now, it would be a heavy burden. And you guys aren't even like a kind of traditional help desk with, you know, a very formal
setup. Like an email inbox.
Right, exactly. So for somebody who's gone through the whole process of looking at 8 tools and narrowing that down and spending months on it, they're already ready to pay. They're committing to you annually. They are making that commitment. So we have, you know, and we've honored these people who are on monthly still, and we have a handful of them, and that's fine, and we'll take their money monthly. But I think those users are not, I don't think they were as good at customers for us, let's put it that way. I think the people who've done the work up front and made the commitment and are putting their money down annually are just a better customer for us. So, yeah, I like the annual a lot. I do think it won't work everywhere, but for us, it's been fun. And we haven't gotten any pushback on it, to be honest with you.
Yeah, that's amazing. My business would be completely different and healthier for it if we only offered annual. I think what I've seen, let's say for card abandonment, for our card hook tool, it wouldn't work to only offer annual. But what I have seen people do and have seen work is to make the annual such a ridiculous no-brainer that it basically just forces the logic into the annual option.
And that's
where it's
what,
like $100 a month or $400 for the year, where it's kind of like, why would I do monthly?
Right? And that's kind of what we're doing. So we're at this point with this.
But then like how much are you lowering your price?
But where
are you lowering your price though?
Our price is a lot lower, but there's a couple of things in that. So first is that if you're at the top of a tier and you bust it out per user per month, it's like under $10. So it's a lot cheaper than most competing systems. But that's balanced with you are committing to us annually, which is a huge plus for us, because now we get that $3,000 today or whatever it is instead of, you know, sprinkled out over the whole lifetime, which is rough, which works out great, right? If you keep them for 3 or 4 years. But I even think it hurts you in keeping them for 3 or 4 years, because there's not that commitment on their end to learn the system and implement it and train people and all that stuff.
Right, it's much easier to get out.
Yeah, it's like, oh, it didn't instantly do the thing I wanted to do. Forget it. I'll move over to this other tool. Maybe that'll instantly do the thing I wanted to do or whatever. And so, I don't know, it's just worked a lot better for us. So it's cheaper, yes, but also it captures that value right now instead of down the road. And then also I just think I do think with subscriptions that there is this kind of pushback. I feel like you have to be a little bit cheaper than with the own license model. Like when we own licenses, it worked out to be a little bit more essentially. But even in the B2B, I feel like people are hesitant on the subscription. Like even like Brian was just saying, paying Slack, right? It's like, oh, that 160, you know, it's coming every month. And that just feels like
a big commitment. Always buying a subscription is tougher. Like buying a $50 a month subscription is harder than a $500 one time.
Exactly.
You know, but so, you know, to what you're saying, Jordan, I mean, I think typical is what, around like 20, 25% off for the annual. But I'm seeing companies do like 40% off, 50% off. And yeah, that's a total no-brainer. But I mean, how much are you lowering your average revenue per user?
Well, I don't know if you really are. I mean, all you have to do is increase your monthly and keep the annual where you want it.
Yeah, you can look at it that way.
It's definitely optics. It's really the big thing that we find internally that would make us prefer the annual is there's something that changes in the interactions between ourselves and prospects, people who are asking questions about trialing, people who are currently trialing. Because we don't know how much they're going to be worth to the company, we don't know what type of attention to pay them. If every deal we talk to was minimum $1,000, it would definitely be a different relationship with the prospects and the people trialing.
Yeah.
But because you don't know if this person's worth $0, $50, or $5,000, you kind of can't give everyone the same attention as if they're worth $5,000. So it's almost like, where are we wasting our time with this person, or is this person an amazing customer? It's really, really hard to tell. Whereas if you know for certain, if this person signs up, it's worth a significant amount of money, you kind of treat the whole relationship differently.
And I think you could probably look back, and this will give you some of it, but I just think in general, the idea of the annual customer, especially, it's a little bit muddied if you have the monthly and then you're upselling them into annual or whatever. But I just feel like you could even be turning potential bad customers into good customers, because the annual just brings a whole different approach from people. They're more thoughtful with it. And again, they're a little bit more committed to making
it work.
Yeah, yeah. I just think I don't know. In our time in monthly, I did not like it. The whole thing of it was bad. We do a lot of one-on-one sales demos. So, you know, I have a person who's just doing sales demos and it could be for $32, you know, like $50 for two
months.
That's
what I mean. Drives you nuts.
So that's a hard thing to do when I know now that the baseline minimum is $600. Like that's the least we're going to get off of any of these sales. And that's
worth most of
them are more. So it's worth that. I don't know. I don't like the monthly myself.
With the Audience Ops done for you service, we've been doing quarterly pricing, like monthly or quarterly. And we offer the quarterly as an option. I mean, I feel like at our price point, the annual just would be a little bit too high. But the quarterly, you know, you get a little bit of a discount. And what I find there is most clients who go for the quarterly, well, we have a higher percentage of quarterly clients than what I've seen in other SaaS. But the other thing is that they tend to be more committed to it because they, you know, it's not just getting a discount. It's like actually giving it at least a few months to start working and get into the workflow, and then they tend to stay on. So it's kind of like I see it as like kind of like a best of both worlds. It's like offer a value pricing option and solve the problem of, okay, they're not just treating this as like a 1 month trial. They're actually kind of committing to it.
Yeah, and it's always a combination of things, right? It's like for us, there's certain flexibility that HubSpot has, like it's downloadable and things like that, where we have, you know, most of our competitors at this point are not downloadable, for example. So that's a unique thing we offer that you can't find everywhere. And same with Audience Ops, like it's not always going to be apples to apples if they're looking at other solutions, because you have specific people who have advantages there. You can show them content in different markets you've written that is applicable to them. And so, you know, other options can't offer them those same things. And so it's like that, it's always that combination, which will make the pricing tricky. It's like the price, but then it's also where it fits in with the rest of your offering and the value there. So
one question, I know Jordan and I have talked about this in previous episodes. If you're just starting up something new, how should you think about pricing so that the business can actually be viable for you as a bootstrapper? Or like, what are the different scenarios you know, where you need to make different considerations into pricing just to ensure the survival of this, of a startup. Cause I just feel like way, way too many people that I speak to are talking about these like $9 a month.
Yeah. That's impossible. And it's like,
it is,
you know,
impossible.
And it's,
I mean, I think those were, I know a few people have done those successfully, but the thing is then you, to me, that's your whole strategy has to be completely different. And it has to be entirely based on, you're going to build a huge audience. You have some type of, you know, advantage that's going to allow you to have a 30 or 40,000 person audience. And then you can sell those people $10 a month things, because if you get enough of them to buy it, that's fine. Because day one, you could get to that baseline of, hey, $2,000 a month, we're already there day one, because I had this big audience and I was able to sell this $10 a month thing into that. But
right. And you've got to have that mind, or that game plan of, okay, we're going big with this. We're going, you know, investment. We're going to put lots of dollars into just growing this audience fast.
Yeah. Or not even, I mean, I know all the people I know have done it are bootstrapped, but they had unique either skills or, you know, some type of advantage that they were able to leverage. And then it wasn't even about the code. Like, the code is now secondary to, you built this big audience either on purpose or by accident, because sometimes it's by accident. And then you're going to leverage that. And that, it's okay, now I could think up a cheap product to sell into this large audience. Like, you know, I've seen that. Or, you know, most of us in this are like, we come at it, a lot of us come at it kind of tech first and like, oh, I want to build this idea for this thing that does something. And that's not really going to work at that $10 a month range, because you're just never going to get enough customers. It's impossible. You know, it's very rare to be able to do that.
Yeah, it's a top-down math versus bottom-up. If you have an audience of 50,000 people on your email list, then maybe you can take the top-down approach of, I know a subset of my list is going to be interested in this, and if that subset is 10,000 people, then I will be able to convert X percent of those. That's right. You can do the top-down math. But most people, you got to do it bottom up. You can't say if it's going to be $29 a month, then you're going to get 1,000 people. How are you going to get 1,000 people one by one?
Yeah. I don't know. If I was starting today, it would be really scary, because I feel like it's a lot harder than it was when I started. I just think there's so much more competition. I think SaaS is so much harder to start up than owned software, speaking in terms of software, because you can just get all that money up front with own software, and this having to take it over months and months just makes the cash flow situation so much harder. Like, you can't get that spike in sales early on your pre-launch list and be like, bam, we're good to go, we're rolling, like I did.
Well,
it's so much harder to do that.
Well, I think you're on the money in terms of what to be fearful of.
Right.
But I do think people can challenge themselves to be creative and find ways around that.
Yeah, you have to.
I think you have to. I'm in the exact same position right now. We've got a brand new software product.
Right.
We're going to charge somewhere about $100 a month.
I'm scared of you.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate that. You with me on this journey.
Yeah, but you know, Jordan, I think that you have established Carthook as a company and a brand and a presence in the e-commerce world. So you have that leverage to build on, and you have the team in place, and you have investors, and you have some runway to do that. And I think that's where the, not that all those things are necessarily required, but
I pretty much ignore all of those. If you want to call those advantages, I don't actually think those are going to make or break.
No, but I think you have a few essential pieces. Essential is the wrong word, but exactly. It's about buying time. And it's the stair-step approach, right? It's getting to this, like positioning yourself for that success. And it takes, you know, laying a lot of groundwork over a number of years, you know, before you're ready to. So I guess what I'm saying is, even when you have the pricing in a workable model, like $99 a month, a couple $100 a month, you know, whether it's per user or whatever, when you start to forecast your first year of making this thing viable, you know, there are other challenges when it comes to profitability and the types of resources that you'll need in order to actually grow it to a number of people that gives you traction, and then support those people and then grow it further.
Yeah, but I'm still trying to defeat that reality that Ian laid out, where if you just go monthly off the bat, it's really, really hard. So we have a new product. I'm literally just looking at a page right now because this conversation made me think of it. I saw a product recently. They came out with a new software product, and they did not offer monthly at all. They said, this is our launch period. Get in early for a reduced annual amount. And after this launch period, we will then be opening it up for $67 a month. So they were offering it for, I think, $397 a year. And that's the only way you could get it. You had to buy for $397. And then they forecast, they kind of foreshadowed. They said, after this launch period, we're going to close the doors. You won't be able to get in. And then we'll release it in a few months for $67 a month.
It didn't
work. So at least it's trying to kind of beat that, those first 6 months where if you just go monthly, your cash flow is screwed, man. It's so hard. So at least they're trying to say, no, let's make a chunk of money upfront, get early users, get established, get a base of cash flow, and then open it up for the regular kind of grind of the monthly price.
I mean, what I've written about before and what I'm trying to do now in Audience Ops is use the productized service as the initial way to, you know, build up the cash flow, but also establish the company and the space where you're, you know, the market that you're in and your audience, and then use that cash flow to then self-fund, you know, expanding the product line, right? And that's kind of where I'm kind of transitioning right now over the next couple of months into next year is like, okay, I basically have, you know, my salary covered, Audience Ops is profitable and growing, got those systems in place, got people in place. Now I need to kind of focus on the next offering from Audience Ops, or at least, and we talked about that in a previous episode, but I feel like now I have way more flexibility and time, like my own personal time of what I can spend my time working on, exploring new product ideas, talking to people, designing wireframes, talking to developers, doing training products, things like that, that I would not have had this kind of leverage a year ago or 2 years ago, you know, just starting something from the ground up.
Yeah, it's breathing room.
Yeah.
Building any kind of unfair advantage you can get, right? Whether it's a steady cash flow from some other product or whatever, or the big audience. I mean, for us, so we moved to subscription, but still the vast, vast majority of our revenue is from existing customers from the past decade who are just paying us support on their own licenses and who are adding more owned licenses because we still have them all grandfathered in. So that's still, you know, the majority of revenue that runs everything as we kind of transition to the long, slow SaaS ramp of death, even though it's not pure SaaS sort of model there. So it's even like, you know, CartHook is kind of like that too. It's like that baseline revenue, even if it's not enough to maybe cover everything on its own, it's still kind of a way to buy that time so that you can have that year, 18 months or 24 months to build up kind of the new big thing. And maybe you should try going annual with it. You know, everybody doesn't do it. Maybe who knows, you know, there's so many people who just follow the leader here and nobody really tries other things a lot of the time, you know? So.
Yeah. No, we are proactively running webinars with the only offer being annual.
That's what I like about what you guys are doing. We talked about it on the previous episode. Like the only way to get the annual is through the webinar.
And you can see that too. If that's popular, maybe it just means that your only pricing should be annual. Like, you know what I mean? It's possible that that's what that means. It could be that it's the offer and it's just the sell and you get people convinced on that. Or it could be that those people are really more dedicated and that if you got more people in the door on that baseline, that people are fine with that because they're going to take the time to integrate this cart, which is a big expensive thing for them to do and is, you know, burdensome to switch away from. And they're going to make that commitment to you. And that would be fine. You
know? Yeah, and I wouldn't be surprised if those are better customers too.
Right, for sure, they'll be better customers. And yeah, and you get those long-term customers. And we have so many long-term customers, and you know them. You know their issues. You know they refer people to you, and you know kind of where they're coming from right from the beginning. So there's so many advantages to having built up those long-term relationships with your customers and people who've used you for 6, 7, 8 years. Obviously, it's a little bit down the line, but even for 1 year or 2 years, it's a huge advantage to have those people kind of in the fold and exposing your product to other people directly and indirectly. So there's that commitment level there. But yeah, it's hard. So when all your competitors are per month, it can be scary for sure.
Well, did we cover everything there is to cover about pricing?
Yeah, it's almost like we talked about pricing repercussions.
Right.
You know, more so than like coming up with pricing. But I guess I'll close out by referring to MicroConf. One of the really big themes that came out of MicroConf Europe was that SaaS can be a grind. even success in SaaS can look like a grind, because as revenue goes up, you need to support more, you need more servers, you need to spend more. So expenses very closely mirror revenue. They go up together. And it looks, at least what I was trying to take away from it, as I heard the same scenario over and over and over again, this grind of SaaS, was that one of the few levers you have is pricing. That's one of the few levers you have that can change the equation of revenue and expenses being so closely tied together. So it's like, it's really worth exploring and looking at and making sure you feel good about it and kind of doing that math of, is this going to work out for me if it goes right?
Well, that wraps it up for today. Let's reconvene maybe next week. We might need to take next week off. We'll see. But
you slacking again, going on vacation?
Yeah, I'm going to be traveling next week with the family. So,
Ian, thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, good to have you on here.
Cheers.
We'll talk soon. Later.